What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting! From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Connor, and welcome to this Friday episode of Intelligence Squared. Today, we're joined by Nicholas Schmidl. He's the staff writer at The New Yorker and author of the new book, Test Gods, Virgin Galactic and the Making of a Modern Astronaut. And in conversation with Helen Chersky, he discussed the new space race, from Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic to Elon Musk's SpaceX. They discuss the astronauts, engineers, and billionaires trying to make civilian space travel a reality. It's a really fascinating conversation, and if you do enjoy it, you can find a link for Nicholas's book in the podcast description. But now, let's go to the episode.
Hello, and welcome to this Intelligence Squared event with me, Helen Chersky. Now, many of us dream of going into space, but in order to get there, you need some pretty specialised vehicles, and there is a risk to life which might be hard to quantify these days, but it's definitely not zero. And until recently, the only sort of method, model we had for getting into space was huge government-funded programmes, you know, with all this national prestige and pride being staked on their success. And so today we find ourselves in this kind of awkward gap between, you know, low Earth orbit being actually pretty routine for a national astronaut, but no tickets are available for anyone who's just, you know, got a lot of money going spare and would quite like to go into space. But there are private companies pushing to fill that gap. And our guest tonight is Nick Schmidl. He's a journalist and author, a regular writer for The New Yorker. And he's been following one of those private companies in particular, Virgin Galactic. He's just written the book about all the things he has seen, or at least all of the things he's seen and can talk about, called Test Gods. And it is out in the UK now. So let us get up into space. Nick, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. This is really fun. I appreciate it.
Well, this is a big story, and it's a big story that you tell from the inside. So we're talking about Virgin Galactic, which is one of those companies. I feel there's a few names, you know, there's kind of Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin and SpaceX. These names kind of get bandied around. Before we get to the details, you wrote this book from the inside. You were kind of sitting in there being a good little fly on the wall. How did you get in there and why did you go?
Yeah, great. Well, so I think there are sort of two questions there, the why and the how. So I'll take the why first. October of 2014, I didn't know anything about Virgin Galactic. Nothing. Absolutely zero. But on Halloween of 2014, Virgin Galactic's spaceship crashed in the California desert. And I remember getting the news alert and being just like stunned and saddened that there was someone was flying Richard Branson, that there was this foreign billionaire, this British billionaire who owned this space company, and they were test flying winged spaceships in the middle of the California desert at supersonic speeds. And not only that, but there were actually sort of test pilots at the controls, you know, unlike some of these other companies, we can talk about the differences later. You know, the other companies are, you know, automated and uncrewed. And at this point, you know, Virgin Galactic, they are early on in the phase from day one. Anytime they light that rocket, there are at least two test pilots in at the controls. And so that immediately seemed to me unique and zany and just full of curiosity. So the fact that there had also been this tragic crash, unfortunately, what often sort of draws me to a story, and at this point, I was working exclusively and for The New Yorker and kind of writing these, you know, I'd spent 6, 8, 9 months on a single magazine story. And so right when that happened, I reached out to my editor and I said, what do you think? Like, we should write about these test pilots. And his response was, sounds great, but only if we can get real access. And by real access, it really kind of meant that you know, Richard Branson's a very savvy, has a very savvy PR operation. And the concern was that we go to them and they say, sure, come on in. And they sort of give us the dog and pony show. But we wanted to see them, like, we wanted to see them work. I wanted to see them build another spaceship. I wanted to see them return to supersonic flight test. And so the idea, so I went to them and I said, you know, you just had this terrible moment, but I want to sort of see how you rise from the ashes. I mean, truly. And so we had a couple of discussions about kind of what that would look like and what the end point would be. And the end point for me always was that I wanted to see them. That was the fourth powered flight. And I wanted to be with them until they flew the fifth powered flight. I wanted to have something definite to hold on to. I didn't want to end as some great, but all too many pieces about Virgin Galactic have ended with a quote from Richard Branson saying, tomorrow will be the day. And so. So that was the framework, and the restrictions were very few. The restrictions were, you know, I said, you don't have to guarantee me anything. Eventually, I want to be a fly on the wall, but you let me in, and if you feel comfortable, you just keep inviting me, and I'll keep coming. And so all told, I made 15 trips to Mojave and was in the room for many of the very critical moments.
Well, we have this saying in England, I don't know if you have it in America, that laws and sausages are similar in that you should never see either of them being made. Is it the same with space rockets?
That's a great question. There are two responses to that, truly, because I think that it the question of my confidence in the program, it actually was at its peak, probably, when I was spending the most time with them. Because I could see how they were working through problems. I knew the men and women at the consoles. I knew the pilots. I knew the engineers. You know, you have that personal relationship. And so you're like, all right, well, I know that, you know, John's going to be able to figure this out. It's now been 3 years, really, since the terms of that arrangement ended. And they've had a number of problems since then. And now when I look back with hindsight, I'm like, crap. They're still dealing with this now in 2021, what they were dealing with in 2016 or 17. And so now, in retrospect, having seen a lot of what I saw, it potentially I have a more fulsome picture of the way that they're sort of doing things. And, you know, you see like, well, this person who in 2016 was like the low man on the totem pole is now running this program. You're like, I don't know, you know, whether I'm not sure that's, you know, in some cases that doesn't necessarily lend confidence. But it's an interesting question because I think that my opinion of it has changed. But I felt probably most confident in where they were going when I was actually seeing the sausage getting made kind of in a day-to-day basis.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we'll come on to this later, but it's interesting precisely because most of us are not seeing the sausage being made, and that is deliberate. But before we get into the details, now, stories are told in terms of individuals. You know, that is how we tell stories. But it also is very striking in this story that, and I don't think it's just how you wrote it, it seems to be true, there are some very strong characters here. There are people who are not necessarily, they might not have all the possible virtues a human could have in other areas, but they are very committed to this. So there are these main characters, you know, Richard Branson, Mark Stuckey, Mike Moses. Just very briefly, just give us a headline of perhaps the three main characters in this story from your point of view.
Yeah, I mean, Mark Stuckey is for me the main character. He when I first met him, he was always the glue that was going to hold all of this together. He's the lead test pilot. And the thumbnail for when I first met him and decided that he was going to be the one who I was going to sort of tell the story from his perspective is that he had been chasing an astronaut dream his whole life through the Marine Corps, through NASA, through the Air Force, and then through Scaled Composites, which was the boutique aviation firm that Richard Branson hired to build Spaceship Two. He flew the first three spaceship rocket-powered flight successfully. He didn't fly the fourth, in which his best friend was killed. And then I showed up as he was preparing and getting ready to fly the fifth. So for me, that seemed the obvious choice. Richard Branson is probably the second leading character, even though he has less page time, just because it's his vision. It's his vision. It's his, you know, he's the one most obviously associated with the program. And then, yeah, I'd say that Mike Moses is probably a third. Mike Moses is the president of the company. He was the vice president at the time that I was there. He's this very sort of folksy Midwestern engineer who has this sort of old school NASA affect. and speaks a mile a minute, is incredibly smart, sort of like too smart. He's already like, he's doing so many things at once that had I not been recording, I would record all of my interviews and conversations with him. And I just follow him around talking to him as he's doing a million things. And I'd have to go back into my hotel and just like put it on, you know, like 0.25 speed to be able to pick up what was going on. Yeah. So Mike was the one who could explain the technology to me in a way that made sense. Richard Branson could sort of explain the vision, and Mark Stuckey could, you know, he was the sort of the heart and soul. But you're right, all of them, and particularly Mark, because I got most deeply in his life, that was what always appealed to me. And that's, you know, there's two subtitles. You know, there's the U.S. subtitle, which is The Making of a Modern Astronaut. And that's, you know, that's what Mark was for me. He was modern in the sense that he was open. He was willing to let this journalist rummage through his email files and everything, and just, you know, kind of put himself out there, which I thought was, you know, that was a really brave thing for him to do. And it gave, I think, a very unique portrait of what an astronaut looks like in 2021, which is he has all of the elements of the right stuff, all the pilots and the from the right stuff. But he also, you have a sense of the graininess and the grittiness and the fraught elements and the less desirable aspects of his personality that you just don't sort of see in those earlier astronaut portrayals.
Well, let's get on to the technology, because that's the sort of the theater in which the story is told. And so this is the type of flights. I mean, we're used to, obviously, you know, when we look back at footage of Apollo and the International Space Station, you know, the shuttle launches and all that kind of stuff. They're rockets, they're vertical rockets. They take off, they whoosh up, they drop a bit off, or perhaps come back to Earth these days. That is not the model that Virgin Galactic are using. So just paint the picture of, you know, everyone's on the runway where this starts. What happens as this flight takes off?
So they have two vehicles that are critical to the whole operation. There's a mothership, which is the White Knight 2, and then there's the spaceship, which is Spaceship 2. Much like the X-planes in the U.S. of the 50s and 60s, these experimental rocket planes, Spaceship 2 is towed up to altitude of about 45,000 feet with the mothership. At which point then the mothership drops the spaceship, the mothership sort of banks away, and then the pilots in the spaceship light the rocket, which flies horizontally for a few seconds, then enters this near vertical ascent. And they then burn the rocket for 60 seconds, sort of crest to the edge of space, and then make this sort of spiral descent down to the runway. And the reason for this, it's really important, I think, for the whole design and in some ways for why they are where they are now, and perhaps why they haven't advanced as much as some of the other companies in recent years, is that they took this design because in 1996 there was a contest with a $10 million prize to the first private company that could put people in space. And the company that won this was this boutique aviation firm, Scaled Composites, and they built airplanes. They built crazy airplanes. They have more airplanes. The designer, Burt Rutan, has more airplanes in the Air and Space Museum, at Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington, than any other aerospace engineer. But that's what they did. And so they just did what they knew, and they put a rocket on the back of it. And as a result, and then Richard Branson came in and said, okay, you know, I want you to make me one of those, but with seats for six, so it can, you know, be the flagship of my program. But that's kind of where they are now. And there are a lot of questions as to, you know, whether they should have rethought the design 10 years ago as they were kind of struggling. Because one of the things is that propulsion doesn't scale. So, you know, you have a spaceship with seats for one and a small rocket motor. And then it's not like you just make it six times bigger and make the motor six times stronger. The whole thing is just it's kind of, you know,
it costs fuel to move fuel, doesn't it? So you
totally
things get complicated.
Totally.
I think that one of the things, so, you know, we won't go into all the details of the technology, but you hinted at this before, and I think it's really important that it's very striking, you know, so we should probably actually clarify that the point of this exercise is to take commercial passengers.
Yes.
They're not direct competitors with SpaceX, who are supplying the International Space Station. They want to take people who've got enough money to buy a ticket to space.
Yep.
So it's a slightly different proposition. But what is very striking, so those of us, especially who watched the first crewed SpaceX launch a few months ago, was it nearly a year ago now? Can't quite remember.
Yeah.
Is that if you looked at the space where the astronauts sat, it was quite frankly very minimalist. It was a kind of white pod with smooth white surfaces. There were a couple of things that looked like iPads, and other than that, there was literally nothing. And of course, we've all been brought up on images of Apollo where there's switches and like every spare space where you could put anything, there's another switch or another dial or another thing or a pencil to write down the thing that you've just turned the dial to. And there's a picture in your book of the cockpit of Spaceship 2, and it's very much not a white pod.
Yeah.
So talk to me a little bit about this decision that to use pilots and not computers.
Yeah, I mean, it's a decision that they, well, it's a decision, I mean, it's a decision that they backed into in some ways because they had, Scaled Composites had proven the concept in 2004, and Richard Branson came in and said, okay, well, you know, prove the concept bigger now, right? So it had already been proven once. There's also, though, I think really central to Richard Branson's whole ethos is this kind of his adventuresomeness, his adventurous spirit, his sort of swashbuckling attitude. I mean, Richard Branson was always going to prefer that experience to the automated one, in which, you know, like you said, I mean, SpaceX is an engineering marvel, and Blue Origin as well. But when you watch the astronauts, you know, they're not doing a whole lot. They're you know, a lot of the work has been done on the ground by the engineers. Now, granted, if there was ever an emergency, I suspect these extraordinarily well-trained astronauts would do something that would, you know, I don't know. But like on a routine flight, there's not much to do. So what did they do? They went out. So Virgin Galactic went out and hired what they thought would be, you know, who they thought would be the most qualified and the finest test pilots that they could find. That makes, for me, that was always the appeal of the story. There was a human element that was just inherently so much more dramatic. There were lives lost. There had already been lives lost. There was so much skin in the game, right? But it also increases the risk factors multifold, because you have so many things that potentially could go wrong. You're banking on so many on humans not making mistakes at so many different opportunities. And so that's I think the challenge that they've run into, which is like the selling point of the whole operation in some ways is also its Achilles heel.
So let's get onto that, because there is this question of it being about the pilot, not the machine. Is sort of critical to this way of thinking. And, you know, that as you said, the sort of subtitle for the American book is about what a modern astronaut is. And so let's get on to who these astronauts are and how they think, because it's very striking that there's a lot in this about ego, right? Yeah. You want a pilot who's going to be the top pilot, the ace, whatever, top dog, top man, whatever it is. There's a lot of testosterone knocking around. This is about the pilot, not the machine. And so let's talk about those pilots and the way that spaceflight, you know, early on in Apollo, it was a very sexist world. Yeah. You know, they got rid of the women astronauts because they couldn't believe they're any good, any about that. Now, it's very noticeable on your book, and this is not a criticism of you, it's a kind of comment on the story, is that all the cover quotes on the book are from men. I don't think a woman appears other than as somebody's wife until page 132. I wrote it down.
No,
this is totally, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, it's totally a little boy's story, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All the little boys who want to grow up and be big pilots who get to throw big things around the sky. And then that's the point of the value system, right? To kind of throw machines around the sky. Is that what we need? How does this work? Because it seems to me that holds it back, as well as pushing things forward, that holds things back. What did you see when it comes to that on the inside?
Yeah, it was so patently obvious when I first got into the hangar. I mean, there were a couple of things. My first experience of walking into the hangar, it's a magical place, right? It's a magical place in the sense of like you walk into a football pitch at night for the first time. And you come through the tunnel and like the lights are brighter than they ever look on TV. The grass is greener than ever looks on TV. And that was a similar thing when I walked into the hangar at Virgin Galactic. There was this is shortly after the crash. There was this half constructed spaceship over on the side. It looked like a set of a Star Wars movie. And one of the other, though, early observations was, wow, there are no women working here. Like, you know, there's like one out of every 10. Now, that's a reflection of engineering schools, though, as well, at least in the U.S. I mean, engineering schools in the U.S. are, I think, like 18% female. So the numbers are you know, it's skewed from the beginning. I remember having a conversation with one of the communication or public affairs people at the company early on. And she said, you know, we really need to, something like we need to find you more women to talk to. And I was like, well, that sounds to be like more of a human resources like hiring question than it is like a journalistic preference question. So no, I'm very keenly aware of that, and I was keenly aware of it as I was writing it. I was keenly aware, you know, my editor my editor, my agent, all the people working on the book and on the U.S. side particularly are all women. And they were like, yeah, you know, it's like it is what it is. But it's obvious, especially at this moment, you know, that this particular moment that we're living in. One of the things that I sort of tried to do was just also, I mean, there's obviously this personal thread that runs through it, and which a lot of that is also wrestling with masculinity and what if I sort of, you know, what's the world that I grew up in and what's the world that I want to sort of, you know, pass down to my children and all that. And it's funny you bring this up just because just today, another retired lieutenant general, a contemporary of my dad's, sent a note to my parents and said, you know, like clearly the book is in some ways a homage to my dad and to all these pilots. But he said, you know, in the acknowledgments, it's the reference, it's the mention that I make of my mom, how like, you know, all this stuff is like chest beating, you know, what does it mean to be a man? But like, it's my mom who's the one who you know, kind of gives me the glimmers of radiance and life and joy and all that. And so I thought about this a lot. I thought about it. I was keenly aware of it. And in some ways, though, like you said, you just sort of write though what it is, and trying to sort of write characters and make characters seem like they are more instrumental to the decision making than they sort of were in my observations of them. It just that felt insincere, you know. So yeah. So it's a I'm glad you noted the page number.
it was just so striking. And it's, as I say, it's not a criticism of you. It feels reading the book as though you told the story as you found it, but it raises these really interesting questions about values. And so now you mentioned your dad there. So let's just briefly describe why this story became a bit more accidentally became a bit more for you than just another journalistic endeavor.
I wrote this magazine piece. This is all first. The first 4 years of the reporting all built towards this big 16,000 word piece for The New Yorker. And then as I sat down to start writing the book, you know, I'm like 4 or 5 years into the project at that point. And I had this moment where I thought I need to stop and ask myself, why am I still doing this? What is keeping my interest? And so it was, so that at that point it became kind of an interrogation of like, what's drawn me to the story. But as you said, I knew already from a very early conversation that I had with Mark Stuckey that he knew my dad and that my dad had been his flight instructor when they were both young Marines in Yuma, Arizona in 1981. You know, I was 2 years old at the time. So that overlap, like I knew that my dad was central to why I was coming to this story. I knew that my interest in it, I knew that why the pilots took me seriously also contributed to who my dad was. And, you know, this built-in presumption that like, well, if I'm Rooster's son, then I must know stuff about aviation. And then they'd start asking questions and they'd be like, oh, nope, he doesn't know anything. So once I figured out, once that personal relationship was clear to me and I figured out that I could sort of weave that storyline in there in a way that hopefully doesn't feel artificial and sort of paste it on, then it felt like it was essential to explaining why I stuck with this story for as long as I did and sort of how it changed me in the process of reporting and writing it.
So just coming back to this issue of values, there was, you know, there's this quote in there, I can't remember who said it, but you quote someone else saying that the question of whether to go into space you need a Ferrari or a Honda Accord. Mm-hmm. You know, this question that people are critical of governments because they, you know, they check everything a million times. They have a million committees to check all the things. And there's all these people who are like, just put it there. Stop messing around. Just get on with putting it into space. And there's this attitude, there's this acceptance of risk, which is interesting because you think that in commercial flight that you would want to be even mere, like professional astronauts basically sign up with the serious possibility they might not come back, whereas someone buying a ticket doesn't. So, but this attitude to risk and the attitude to this kind of glorification, if you like, of the test pilot.
Yeah.
How is that appropriate in the modern world? Like, how does it, like, do we need that? I guess that's what I'm getting at, is do we still need, now that we know it's possible, do we still need to have, oh, we need the cowboys to go out and, you know, do these super risky things?
So a couple of things. The question of the Honda versus the Ferrari, it comes down to the like when you're building a prototype, right? I mean, that's the philosophy of you're just trying to test a vehicle. You're trying to see what works and what doesn't work. And Elon Musk has made this comment. Burt Rutan, who's the aerospace visionary who designed Spaceship One and Spaceship Two, to a lesser extent, they both sort of subscribe to this philosophy. Just get it in the air. Let the test pilots figure out what the problems are. Let the test pilots get it back down, and then we can sort of make the necessary tweaks and adjustments. The question about like the glorification of it, I think that what also I found so compelling was that there were people still doing this in 2021. Like it seemed to me when I first came to the story, it seemed to me I thought that this life of test pilots, particularly for a private company, I didn't think that people took risks like that anymore. Like you think that we live in such a sort of such a mechanized, such a, I don't know, the U.S. is also so different because it's so like, you know, everything's wrapped up in insurance and bought, you know, like the fact that there were people doing that, there were people, like you said, that were test flying rockets. That to me seemed out of place. It seemed retro, right? I mean, that's I think what actually why I came to, because it was like, well, what is this subculture in the middle of the California desert? Do we need that? I think it is healthy to have, I think that desire to push yourself and to expand the envelope is like literally the technical term. But I think that desire to kind of to explore what is unexplored. And I think that if there are people who can do that better than machines. And I think that is really healthy for us as a society and as a human race. I mean, I think it's important. I think that is, I'm not taking those kinds of risks, but the absorption of that risk calculus, I think, was really helpful for me at this point in my life as well, about thinking like, what do I want to do next and how do I want to do it? And, you know, putting myself in the book was like a personal choice that I kind of, you know, I sat there and thought like, do I want to do this? This is a risk. I could write a conventional book without myself in there. I think this makes the book significantly better, but it's also taking a risk because it gives someone something not to like about it, right? It's not just like, so yeah, so I do think it's important. There is a female test pilot at the company now, but like she's not flying the spaceship at the moment. But yeah, it'd be great to have more. I mean, this is why I think that in that final scene of the book, in which there is this woman who becomes Beth Moses, Mike Moses' wife, who does become an astronaut. Having my two sons watch her become an astronaut, I think was a really important thing for them too, to see like, it's not just an old, you know, it's not just a boys club. You know, it's not just a bunch of old men that are in their sort of late 50s that have had these illustrious military careers that are doing this. Yeah, it's a long-winded way of hopefully touching on your question.
We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient, so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
Let's come back to the sausages. So there's this sort of one of the other threads that runs through the book is the question of what the public and investors and potential passengers know and what the engineers know. And there's this tension because obviously anyone who's trying to sell tickets or sell the idea is like, yes, we're going to do this thing. We're ready to go. It's going to be next year. And the engineers go, maybe yeah. not.
Right.
How much do the public need? Like, how much does this need to fly on a dream? And how much is that just, you know, a bit too much marketing spin?
Yeah, that has changed a little bit because now that Virgin Galactic is a publicly traded company, it has like a fiduciary responsibility to keep the public updated as to what's happening. But that's also, you know, I think they wrestle with that as a company. Do we every day, like if someone like turns a wrench and a screw breaks off, are we supposed to, you know, convey that to the shareholders? I think it's a central tension of the story because Virgin companies have traditionally and historically not made stuff. They have repurposed existing industries and, you know, and made them better and made them more sort of, you know, user friendly or whatever, and made them flashier, but they haven't made stuff. So it's like really and truly with the, you know, Richard Branson was making records in the early 70s, but then from then until 2005, and particularly really until 2015, early 2015, when they took over all operations for the spaceship after the crash and Scaled Composites was out. I mean, they went from not doing anything to building spaceships. And that tension between the fact that the company is a marketing company. Like Virgin is in many ways a really savvy marketing company that was suddenly thrown into the business of turning wrenches and building spaceships. And I think that everyone, I mean, that was just, it was a central theme of it has been a central theme of the program for the past 15 years is kind of getting out of their own way. You know, Elon Musk is apparently a very difficult person to work for, extraordinarily high expectations. You know, he does sort of get ahead of himself and give flight schedules that are oftentimes, you know, ahead of himself, but he's still sort of producing. And he may not be on Mars as early as he wanted to be. He may not be on Mars by 2023, I think was his early, you know, initially he said he wanted to be on Mars in 2023. That's probably not going to happen. But like, he's still doing some extraordinary stuff on a very regular basis. With Virgin, it was kind of like trying to clear the smoke and mirrors away and to see like what's really there. I do think that they have the ability to continue to fly to space. But I don't know if they have the ability to like really turn this into the functioning sort of space line, repeated operations kind of operation that they have talked about and think that this has the potential to be. And certainly as their financial statements suggest that it is and will be in the coming years.
Well, let's just summarize that perhaps. So in terms of progress, you know, in this whole world of commercial spaceflight, we've got SpaceX, who are now a regular. They are basically supplying the International Space Station. They are taking cargo. They're taking astronauts. they kind of got that sewn up, as far as I can tell. NASA are not building their own rockets. And then these other two, Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic, what's the status of what they're actually doing now?
Well, as of today, Blue Origin, so they're sort of, Blue Origin's primary or initial business was all suborbital space tourism. And Virgin Galactic's exclusive business with maybe side, Virgin Galactic, they are a suborbital space tourism company, meaning, and this gets into a sort of a nerdy side digression if we want to talk about like what the edge of space
is. But, line is, yeah. Well, it's actually important though, isn't it? Because I think it's one of those things where, as a marketing thing, like, you know,
yes.
as a scientist, I'm like, you know, it's somewhere in the upper atmosphere. Pick a point, right, where you decide where the edge of space is. But actually, if you're investing in someone, the difference between suborbital flight, which is just below the von Karman line, and low Earth orbit, which is just above it, you know, technically 100 meters makes an enormous difference to your investors.
Right. Well, So we'll do a quick sort of, so the von Karman line, right, is 100 kilometers, 62 miles. In the United States, according to the U.S. Air Force, they give astronaut wings to anyone who flies above 50 miles, which is 264,000 feet. I think it's about 82 kilometers. That last part I may not have, that last conversion. I know it's 264,000 feet.
That's pretty much, I think you're about right. Yeah.
Okay. So all along, everyone has always been gunning for the von Karman line, right? That's the international accepted standard. Virgin Galactic also was aiming for that until in 2018, they said, we're going to space. And they went to 50 miles and they said, you know, okay. And they've gotten their astronaut wings. So like they are those test pilots who flew that are astronauts. But I think Jeff Bezos himself said like, yeah, you know, there's an asterisk next to their name. So you could see where this suborbital rivalry, space tourism rivalry, is going to go when Blue Origin actually begins operations. They're going to disparage Virgin Galactic for saying that you're not even flying to space, or they're going to sort of snicker. And you know, as of today, Blue Origin, which began taking bids on seats for its, I think, July flight, I think they announced that there's a bid for $2 million that's already on the table. Yeah, so that's actually like that's the arena to watch in the near term. Blue Origin also has a deep space exploration ambition, much like SpaceX, but they're not there yet. They're not, like you said, they're not supplying the International Space Station, and they certainly are not building test flying rockets like SpaceX's Starship, which, you know, is the amazing thing that does the belly flop and lands and most of the time. So
basically, there's still Virgin Galactic not there yet. They've got more test flights to do. They've got a plan, but
So I think it's helpful. Yeah. So they flew to space. Virgin Galactic flew to space in December of 2018 and in February of 2019, and it looked at that point like they were really going to make a go of it. I mean, they had two space flights in just over 2 months. Unfortunately, they've not flown to space since, and there was an engineering problem that grounded the spaceship for more than a year. They had a December 2020 flight that was aborted. They had a February 2021 rescheduled flight that was postponed at the last minute. So they are right now, it's hard to know exactly the extent of the problems. And then last week they announced that they're all ready to go, but now the mothership has some problems. So yeah, they can't get out of their own way at this point. But that's they're hoping to fly sometime soon-ish, whatever that means.
Okay, so just before we get to the questions from the audience, so audience, be putting your questions in. One more question for you, Nick, which is, if Virgin Galactic offered you the passenger seat on their next test flight, like as Beth, I've forgotten her surname, but
Beth Moses,
she went,
yeah.
If they offered you that seat tomorrow, would you go?
No. I would have. If you would have asked me that question 3 years ago, right when I was finishing this up, I definitely would have. But the lack of visibility, you know, again, you know, coming back to that point I made earlier about like, you know, you're around the test pilots and you're sort of, you know, when you go skiing and on the first day someone says, you know, you want to ski that double black diamond. You're like, no way. And then by the fifth day, you're like, you know, I feel pretty good. I'll go ski that double black diamond. Like you've been hanging out with skiers. You're sort of, you know, you're one of them kind of for a few days. You're seeing people do crazy things in the mountain. That's sort of how I felt. I felt like I was with the test pilots. I was in the centrifuge with them. I was flying with them. I was doing all the high G stuff with them. There's a little bit, I'm sure, of ego built into that as well. There was also the fact that I was about to start writing this book, and I thought, well, how amazing would that be for the book if I flew to space? The book's done. So like, I go to my wife now and I say, hey, I want to go to space tomorrow. And she's going to be like, well, wait a second. What about all the second thoughts you've been having? And the book's already done. Like, ah, I don't know about that. So on the next flight, probably not. But, you know, like, show some record of repeated success. And I think that, you know, that calculus could change.
Okay, well, let's get on to the questions from the audience here. So first one up is from Sarah, and she'd like to know whether there are any competitors in China or any other country who could either compete with Virgin Galactic or outcompete them. Because obviously there are countries in the world other than America.
Yeah, yes. So I don't know of any other private companies that are there. I mean, certainly the Chinese government could. I mean, look, the Russian government for a while was offering this. It was extraordinarily expensive, but the Russian government would say, look, if you have, you know, $20 or $30 million, you can buy a seat on a Soyuz rocket and you can go to the International Space Station. And NASA hated this. It was, you know, this is like in the late 90s, early 2000s, but Americans and others were doing this. So that, I don't know if the Russians are still taking money, because I think that now if you're a wealthy person in Western Europe or the U.S., I think you're often going to now, you're going to be looking to SpaceX to you know, give SpaceX a bunch of money to go than you would be on an old Soyuz rocket that's, you know, hasn't, you know, the Soyuz has been in the air since like the 70s. You know, this is an old design, and it's, you know, it's the AK-47 of rocket designs. It's old, but like, God, that thing is still chugging along.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right? Right, totally.
I mean,
totally.
I would ride the Soyuz versus of super new modern technology that was untested, because the Soyuz has definitely been tested.
Totally.
So we've got another question here. I don't think there's a name attached to it. And it's, does the fact that this is a project that's led by the super rich for the benefit of the super rich, does that make you queasy?
What made me queasy and what makes me queasy is when they talk about how it's for anything other than that. When they talk about how this is a project to democratize space and how we're going to open up space to the rest of the world, that's when it feels insincere and disingenuous, and just that's what makes me uncomfortable. If they would just say, you know, this is the way, like, this is, you know, it's big money kind of going into the project. Prices will go down, you know, maybe sometime for like those who don't have major means, you might be able to fly. Like, I think that would be, that somehow would be more palatable than when they start throwing out this democratization of space rhetoric, which I always kind of was like, ooh, don't don't start with that. It just, that's what felt, I don't know, kind of. Like I said, it felt like they were selling a concept and not selling the reality. And look, the response internally to my article and to me continuing to write this book has in some ways reflected that. I think there are many in the company. I know there are many in the company who said, like, Nick captures what we do and it's risky. And, you know, three engineers died in 2007 and one test pilot died in 2014. And like, it's been really hard and we've had all these hardships and it's dangerous. And there have been a bunch of aborted flights and you know, there have been a bunch of flights that have, you know, had things go wrong. And then there are others who say, well, yeah, but, you know, Nick's making it sound scary and we don't want to scare away the rich investors. And that's when I'm like, guys, like, it is what it is. Like, I'm not making these things up. So the democratization of space it leaves me a bit unsettled sometimes.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's not new. You know, Apollo was all about military dominance. It was about whether America was better than Russia. And so that thing of, you know, one step for all man, it's true. A nice line, but Apollo was not funded for all man, right? So it's
true.
It's interesting how they feel the need to hold on to this. Oh, it's fine because we're doing it for everyone, when in either case, it's so clearly not true. Right. I guess you could make a claim for the very first step being it's possible for a human, but even then, you know.
Yeah, I mean, for some reason, using this sort of universal language to mask truly nationalist ambitions seems to me, I can sort of get behind that a little bit easier than I can the universal rhetoric that's masking like sort of elitist reality. There's some, I don't know why.
I like this, the idea of this being a Rorschach test for your ethics, however, like the way you see it. Well, there's another question here, which is on a sort of unrelated topic in a way, which is, so there's also no name attached to it, but it's that Jeff Bezos is you know, also working on bringing people to space. It's very noticeable they're all billionaires, but what motivates them? Branson, Bezos, Musk, why? They could do anything, right? Why are they going into space?
I think the answer is baked into the question because
they've run out of money to spend on Earth.
Yeah, right. It's a playground. This is the ego contest. Like what human is going to be able to build a vehicle that's going to be able to ferry other humans to Mars? Like that's, what bigger sort of test of vanity and ego exists, right? And I think that, I mean, Elon Musk had these dreams long before he had the means to really, I mean, he had these dreams way, way, way back when he sort of aspired to have the means to be able to actually sort of, you know, to be one of the richest men in the world. You know, I feel like him and Jeff Bezos sort of swap on a day-to-day basis.
Depending on who's tweeted what most recently.
Right, totally. And which to Jeff Bezos is, you know, I feel like... Jeff Bezos at least just stays out of the limelight as much as possible. But yeah, I think that it comes down to ego, and it comes down to sort of, you know, trying to leave your mark on the world, on the universe. I don't know. I can't. That's a perspective. I feel like I could understand the calculation. I feel like I could understand the mentality of the test pilot, having you know, grown up with a fighter pilot, and like when I first met Mark Stuckey, you know, I kind of knew that type immediately. And I felt like I could then write about him in a way that felt real and intimate. I can't do that with Richard Branson or Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk. Like there's an air gap between sort of my approach to the world and their approach to the world.
And well, coming back to the risk, there's a question here about whether NASA has been wrongly portrayed as risk averse by those who have most to gain from space travel. Because of course, when people forget, you know, Apollo 1, astronauts died when it was during a fire on the launch pad, that no NASA pilots have been killed. Astronauts have been killed in orbit, but they have definitely been killed on the way there and on the way back. So is NASA wrongly portrayed as risk averse, and how does that narrative benefit private companies?
Yes, I think NASA is an easy punching bag for all of these companies, right? What was the value of the space shuttle program? You know, there was, you know, the shutting down the space shuttle program was seen as the epitome of NASA's sort of moribund, you know, that it had reached this moribund phase of life and that NASA had no value to offer. I mean, NASA's flying helicopters on Mars, you know, like there are not people that are throwing the helicopter. Like, I mean, I'm not sure sort of what more, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know where the risk, I don't know what more people would want. I mean, NASA said when they shut down the space shuttle program, that like they're looking for their deep space exploration venture at this point. So I do feel like they're an easy punching bag. And how does it benefit? I mean, it benefits because it's the David and Goliath sort of rhetoric. I mean, it's this, you know, Burt Rutan. There's a scene in the book in which Burt Rutan at the announcement of the XPRIZE in 1996 they just announced, okay, we're going to give $10 million to the first private company. And Burt Rutan knows that, like, he's thought to be, you know, he's the presumed front runner in this race. And he spends the whole morning just browbeating the NASA administrator and telling him how NASA's slow and all this. And Burt shared emails in which he and Newt Gingrich are going back and forth talking about how terrible NASA is and like what they need to do. But I will say what Burt's point was, and this I think is a failing of NASA, is that NASA has in recent years failed to inspire. And I think that's actually like a central theme as well. Like NASA, it's a failure of NASA's sort of PR machine, if you will, to like show people what they are doing and to inspire young men and women, particularly women right now, as we were talking, like, you know, young female scientists, young female students to want to be scientists and engineers and to kind of, so I think that is, it's almost like the programmatic failures or the programmatic shortcomings are there, but it's the messaging that's also fallen short. It's that NASA, what does NASA stand for anymore? Well, it doesn't stand for sort of breaking down boundaries because that's just, you know, they've lost that narrative. And that narrative now belongs to Elon Musk in some ways.
Just wanted to pick up on that point though, because I think the next stage is really interesting because basically the problem of going to Mars, The real problem is the least sexy problem of all time. It's not a great big monster to beat. It's not the distances of space. It's not the rocket engines. It's the radiation that will give you terminal cancer by the time... I think the last statistics were that by the time you arrived at Mars, even on the shortest possible transit, you would have a one-third chance of having terminal cancer.
Oh, interesting.
So the problem they've got is... And the problem with radiation is you can't fight it with a big stick, I think. Uh-huh. So I think that's NASA's problem. It's that... You've got this, well, what all you can do is hide from it.
Huh.
And that is not a sexy thing to do, you know, in the world of test gods. No one wants to be hiding from the radiation. I don't know if anyone mentioned that in your, I guess, maybe Virgin Galactic aren't talking about Mars yet.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Huh. Yeah, no, I haven't thought about that at all. I mean, I think the other least sexy thing is that you show up and Mars looks like the least interesting and least hospitable place on Earth. You know, it's like it's far worse than like the most inhospitable spot of the Gobi Desert. And you're like, well, wait a second, why did I just travel however, you know, 7 months to get here? So,
and that is why planetary, like Earth scientists like me, spend our whole time going, perhaps we should look at this planet. But yeah. Anyway, it's quite nice on our planet. It's quite interesting. Okay, so we've got another question here, which is sort of... It's interesting in a very practical way. I think this is from Michael. And Michael says that, you know, we hear all the time that planes and commercial aviation are not good for the planet, let's say. Is it the same with space travel? And how does that square with everyone's, you know, newly and encouraged enthusiasm for not destroying the atmosphere or our own planet?
Yeah, it's a really tricky question because... like, perhaps... One could argue that Elon Musk and the creation of Tesla and you know, electric vehicles is accepting and countering in a way more than any other sort of, you know, big billionaire who has, you know, is doing more to sort of to counter the effect of climate change with electric vehicles. But what is the carbon footprint of a single rocket launch versus the carbon footprint of, you know, 50 electric vehicles or whatever? Like, I don't know what that calculation looks like. I also know, unfortunately, that the average citizen in the U.S. probably cares less, and which is where, you know, all these companies are based, is probably less embracing of the science of climate change than your average citizen in Europe, which is just, you know, an unfortunate reality. I think it's a really important and pressing question. I don't have a great answer to it because I don't know, like I said, I don't know what the carbon footprint is of these individual rockets. Like, I don't know how you know, a spaceship to Virgin Galactic flight, how does that compare to a, you know, how many 747 transatlantic flights is that? I'm not sure. I did want to come back to one thing you just said, and we were talking about this, the importance of this planet. You know, one of the reasons why when I first was getting into this project, you know, I'm not inherently interested in deep space exploration or landing on Mars. And I think that probably 99% of the book takes place here on Earth. Like, it's, you know, space is kind of this metaphor. We're all looking up to space. We're all sort of thinking about how we can transcend ourselves and expand ourselves and do all that. But like, and in the end, those... You know, I don't want to spoil the ending, but like, Mark Stuckey chases this astronaut dream his whole life. And then when he gets the dream, when he achieves the dream, like that moment that I spent with him that night, in which he's kind of reckoning with, like, yeah, you know, that was pretty cool. But, you know, it's equally cool that I'm like there's a renewed appreciation, I think, also for, you know, kind of what this planet has to offer. And that is one of the, you know, that is one of the things that Richard Branson, I've heard him say that. And it does feel genuine. And I think that's kind of, you know, this was always like for me an earthly book rather than a space book and a project that was kind of about finding value in this world as much as, you know, the ones beyond.
So there's a practical question here, which is particularly on this type of flight, I think the one Virgin Galactic is proposing. There's no name attached to it. But what kind of activities would space tourists do other than look out of the window? I mean, the view out of the window is probably quite good.
Yes, yes. I mean, the view out of the window is stunning. Not much. You're not up there that long, right? I mean, you have time to unbuckle. You have time for a few somersaults. You have time to, you know, the view is stunning. I, you know, the photographs outside the cockpit are pretty amazing. But there's not too much time to do other things. I mean, I suspect you're your heart is still, you're still sort of, you know, dizzy from this adrenaline rush of that 60 second rocket burn, and then preparing. I mean, I will say, having gone through the flight profile and the centrifuge, going down is a lot nastier than going up. Going up, you know, you're feeling the G's in your chest, and you know, you have that sort of that rush as you're, you know, as the sky, as it's getting darker outside your windows. Going down, it's like coming back from a vacation, except that you're also getting this like anti-head rush where all the blood is rushing to your feet. Of way, you know, you're coming back from vacation. You've got the low of like, ah, crap, I'm coming back to Earth now. And all the G's, you know, you're feeling all the G's sort of, you know, as the blood's draining from your head. And so, yeah, I was significantly less impressed after doing the G profile once for the passengers. And I said, well, okay, why don't you do a pilot profile at 100%? And I said, you know what? I don't need to prove myself anymore. I'm good for the day. So
I can see why they didn't hire you as a salesperson for their program. Although it is, if people want to float, you know, you can do zero G flights on Earth where planes drop out of the sky. And I have done that, and you get to turn a teddy bear and you don't get what you just described with the horrible number of G's. Okay, so next question down here. In the next decade, do you think civilian space travel is going to be normal or even possible?
I mean, yes. I don't know what normal would look like. I mean, is normal, you know, weekly flights, monthly flights? I think monthly flights are certainly within the realm of possibility. Whether that's, I mean, I think that SpaceX is approaching a point where SpaceX could, I mean, SpaceX this year alone could fly three of them would be NASA missions, but then there's the Inspiration 4 mission scheduled for the fall, which will be their first sort of, you know, tourist mission. So I think that you could see the tempo increase pretty significantly. Will, you know, Virgin Galactic be there flying weekly flights? Like they say they're going to be doing in 2023, 2024. That's a lot harder for me to kind of to envision. I hope, because I've invested sort of so much in their, you know, like I want to see them succeed because I know how much I know the people that are sort of there in the trenches, and I know how much it would mean for them to succeed. And I know, you know, so it's like, it's not because I want, you know, them to clear the 600 millionaires off of their flight list to be able to get that experience. But, you know, because I think that they're trying to do something that no one's ever done. And, you know, you want to see people, you know, I don't want to see anyone fail that's trying to do something like that. But there are a lot of obstacles in the way. And so, but I do think that SpaceX will be there. I think the Blue Origin could be there as well. And I think, you know, there are other companies that are certainly watching and learning from the successes and failures of the three we've been primarily talking about, who I have no reason to think that there won't be other companies emerging in the next few years that could easily, by the end of the decade, you know, be doing this. So
I have one final question for you. We're almost out of time, which is, you know, you describe being surprised that this world of test pilots is kind of still there. You know, perhaps in 10 or maybe 20 years' time, these flights will become routine, we think. It seems likely. And, you know, the cachet of being called an astronaut will, you know, there might have to be two categories, because if you're a passenger astronaut, perhaps that's not the same. So what does someone like Mark Stuckey do in a world where there are no flights to be a test pilot on? What happens to a mentality like that when they can't scratch that itch?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think that his generation realizes that in some ways they are the last generation. You know, military pilots are coming through, and the military cockpit is far more automated than it ever was. They are still the pilots are still at the controls, but there's a lot more automation happening. So I think you just sort of, in some ways, those who, the numbers are smaller. You know, you have, you know, a few years ago, you saw that, like, you had pilots that were sort of leaving the pilot corps and going and being in the drone corps and, you know, sitting there with joysticks. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like that makes these pilots incredibly anxious and probably makes their palms sweat and depressed, thinking that, like, that is the next generation, or that's their life. And so I think they all actually kind of consider themselves very fortunate to be able to still do this at this stage in their lives, knowing that there probably is not a lot, there's not another generation of test gods sort of waiting, you know, right behind them. And I will just say, in the end, the test gods quote is not, it sounds very sort of, It sounds as though I've sort of thrown myself at their feet. It actually was coined by another test pilot at, there was the bet, and this is relevant, a bet that Mark Stuckey made with a NASA astronaut in 2009 as to who would get to space first, this NASA astronaut or Stuckey. And the loser had to buy the other one a dinner and margaritas at this Mexican restaurant outside of Edwards Air Force Base. And Stuckey lost. And the dinner was in January of 2019. And I went to the dinner and it was supposed to just be two or three people. And in the end, there were like 40 people that all showed up. And when Stuckey and Fisher got up and they were talking about their bet and giving the history, there was this other test pilot in the back of the room who said, when Stuckey stood up, he said, that's the Chuck Yeager of his generation. And then when Fisher stood up, he said, those guys right there, those guys are test gods. And so I thought at that moment, I was like, all right, so you've got within the community, you have others that even sort of recognize that there are some that are, you know, that have the right stuff and that are sort of, you know, ahead above the rest. And so, yeah. So, but I don't know where those guys all see themselves or see their sort of sons and see their future selves in 30 or 40 years. It's a great question, though.
Well, humans haven't run out of adventures yet, so I'm sure there'll be something. Brilliant. We are out of time, which is a great shame. It's been fabulous to talk to you. Thank you very much, Nick. Yeah. The book, Test Gods, is available. So thank you to everyone who was listening. Thank you to Intelligence Squared for organising this. Thank you to the bonkers test pilots who are apparently still giving us amazing stories to tell about going into space. And thank you, Nick.
Awesome. Thank you.